thank you for listening to another Hastings NAS podcast. We are so pleased that you have shown interest in listening to this podcast, and we pray that it is edifying and beneficial for you. You can watch us live every Sunday morning on Facebook, facebook.com/HastingsNAS. And if you are so inclined, you can support the ministries of the church by going to hastingsnas.org/give. Hope you enjoy this sermon. Grace and peace. Church, did you notice that we read the same thing twice this morning? Did you catch that? Well, kind of. I mean, we read two separate passages, right? Isaiah 9, then Matthew chapter 4. But we read the same text, which is interesting. Only the second time we read it, we read the words, I hope, with a bit more clarity. I hope that after reading the words a second time, we could see that there was maybe a little bit more going on than the first time we read it. This week, as Pastor Bickerman and I were meeting and talking about how to put the order of service together, I said, let's read Matthew first. Let's go with Matthew first, and then we'll read Isaiah later in the service. And then I was like, wait, no, we have to read Isaiah first. We have to read Isaiah 9 first, and then we'll go over to Matthew chapter 4. We have to read it in the order in which it was recorded, because we need to listen to it twice. And hopefully after we listened to the words of the second time, we could see kind of a deeper purpose, a deeper meaning in those texts. Matthew, the author of the Gospel of Matthew, or maybe a better title for the Gospel of Matthew, is the Gospel of Jesus Christ, according to Matthew, sees that Jesus Christ is the fulfillment of what the prophet Isaiah wrote about the restoration of Israel. Matthew is kind of borrowing the Hebrew scriptures, because Jewish and Old Testament scholars generally agree that the prophet Isaiah had something particular in mind when he recorded Isaiah chapter 9, or maybe better, it is someone in mind when he wrote Isaiah chapter 9 verses 1 through 4. Someone other than Jesus. The prophet Isaiah probably had someone particular in mind in his lifetime. And most scholars would agree that that's probably King Hezekiah. King Hezekiah was who Isaiah probably anticipated the one to be, because King Hezekiah enacted strong religious reform in Israel at that time. Isaiah wrote what he did at a time when the Assyrian Empire had taken over the northern kingdom, the land of Zebulun and Naphtali. See, these lands of Zebulun and Naphtali, Galilee by the sea, these were part of the land that was given to Israel as God's promised land. Zebulun and Naphtali were two of Jacob's sons, and each of Jacob's sons received a portion of land in the kingdom, in the nation that God had given them. But the northern kingdom of Israel fell. The northern kingdom had been sacked, had been taken over by Assyrians, by the Assyrian Empire. So the prophet Isaiah is writing at a time when the nation of Israel is not only divided between north and south, he's writing at a time in which the northern kingdom is not even there. Land of Zebulun and Naphtali is under foreign occupancy. It is thought at the time that King Hezekiah will not only restore the northern kingdom, but will reunite Israel to be one glorious kingdom again. And then we come to Matthew, and we read the same thing again. Land of Zebulun, land of Naphtali, Galilee of the Gentiles. We read the same thing, only it's different. It's almost like, you know those movies you have to watch twice for them to make sense? To understand what's happening? It's like The Sixth Sense. You remember The Sixth Sense? Spoiler alert, Bruce Willis was dead the whole time. If you didn't know that, I'm sorry, the movie's 24 years old now. At the end of the movie, we learn that Bruce Willis was dead the whole time. I see dead people, and he was one of them. Or A Beautiful Mind? You remember A Beautiful Mind, which tells the story of genius mathematician John Nash, played by Russell Crowe? And at the end of the film, we learn that he is paranoid schizophrenic. He's this brilliant mathematician who will win the Nobel Prize, but it tells the story and he has all these people in his life that just bring kind of this chaos to him. And at the end of the movie, we realize, we learn that he's paranoid, schizophrenic, and all those people that he experienced throughout the film aren't real humans. They're part of his schizophrenia. So you got to rewatch the movie again. And you see that this little girl, that she never ages throughout his life. Why doesn't she get older? And she runs and plays through the birds, but the birds don't fly away. Why don't the birds fly away? The story makes more sense. You notice things. When you watch the movie again, you start to notice things that you didn't notice the first time. And I think that's what happens when we read the words, "The people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. And for those who sat in the region and shadow of death, light has dawned," in both Isaiah and in Matthew. The first time we read it, it's a great story. It is true. It is valuable. But once Matthew grabs a hold of it, once the gospel writer Matthew grabs a hold of this text and says, "Yes, but wait, there's more. You thought this is what's going on. Oh, no. Let me tell you, this ain't about Hezekiah, okay? This is about someone else." We see the deeper meaning and things start to make sense that maybe didn't make sense the first time we read it. Now we see that it's not only about King Hezekiah, but it's about Israel's Messiah, Jesus Christ, the King. The situation during Isaiah's writing and Matthew's writing were similar, but the resolution maybe is a little bit different. See, at the time of Jesus, I already told you what was going on when Isaiah wrote, when the kingdoms were divided. Now, at the time of Jesus, Zebulun and Naphtali were a part of the region of Galilee in the northern kingdom. They were in a similar situation as when Isaiah originally prophesied. During Isaiah's time, they were under Assyrian control. They were part of a foreign empire. Their goods and their resources, their land was being utilized for the sake of Assyria. Now, it's a little bit different. When Jesus heard that John the Baptist had been beheaded, what did he do? It says he fled. He was apparently in the southern kingdom around the region of Judea, probably in the wilderness out by the Jordan, in the southern kingdom. And when John is beheaded, he goes back up north. He goes back to Galilee, but not just to Galilee. He goes to Capernaum, which is one of the northernmost cities in all of Galilee. He fled Judea. He went to the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, lands that were a part of God's promised land, but also lands that had become part of a foreign empire. You see, when Jesus fled to Capernaum, he was still in God's promised land, and he was still in that region of Galilee, which was still technically part of Israel's rule, but, as we know, Israel was under Roman occupation in Galilee more so than Judah. Galilee more so than Jerusalem, where the center of Israel life was taking place. More so than Judah, Jerusalem, and the southern portion of the nation, the northern region, Galilee, Capernaum, these were a strong part of Rome's economy. Jesus is in God's territory, but he is also in a foreign land. You see, the region of Capernaum was a land and were waters whose resources and goods were used not just for the sake of Capernaum, but Rome relied heavily on Galilean fishermen. Rome relied on the fish from the Sea of Galilee, largely taken from the massive seaport in the northern coastal city of Capernaum. Capernaum, we know, was a major Roman city. When we think of the first disciples being fishermen, what do you think of? I think of the flannelgram, going back to Sunday school. These were fishermen who were lowly, little fishermen who were catching fish to feed their families, maybe to sell at the market in town. It's quaint. It's cute. I don't want to burst your Sunday school bubbles, but that's not what was going on here. Not in Capernaum. Because Galilean fishermen were largely a very significant, even if at the bottom rung of the totem pole, part of the Roman economic machine. These fishermen were part of a state-backed corporate system. Their catch would get shipped all over the region throughout the Roman Empire. Not just to feed their families and not just to feed the village of Capernaum or Nazareth. Oh, they were utilized to support Roman economic interests. These fish were utilities to feed Roman soldiers, Roman occupiers. And maybe this is why Isaiah and then Matthew after him talk about people who sat in darkness and people who live in a land of deep darkness. A people who have had their personal and professional dignity taken away from them. A people whose land and whose waters have been prostituted for imperial purposes. Did you notice how quickly Andrew and Simon Peter followed Jesus? Did you see how quickly the sons of thunder, the sons of Zebedee, left their father and went to follow Jesus? The text says two times, immediately. Maybe they dropped their nets immediately and followed Jesus because they were sick of being fishermen for Roman economic interests. And because Jesus called them to become fishermen for humanity. Church, I want to reframe this text a little bit. Perhaps what Jesus is doing here is providing an opportunity for them to stop fishing for the machine. Maybe what Jesus is doing here is providing an opportunity for them to stop doing the bidding of Rome. Perhaps Jesus is providing a way for them to stop fishing for the empire, for the system, for the disembodied economic interests of oppressive powers. Jesus is telling them, perhaps, that they can use their skills, they can use their talents, they can use that which God has given them for the good of people, not just for the good of the system. You see, basically what Jesus is saying is, stop fishing for the interests of the empire, and I will make you fishers for humanity. Stop fishing for the sake of Rome. Fish for the sake of people. You see, the text is built together in such a way that I'm going to geek out a little bit about grammar. You okay with that? I got a yes up front. That's all I need. There's no preposition in the Greek here. In English, we say, I will make you fishers of men in the King James, right? Or, in what we read this morning, the New Revised, I will make you fish for people. There's no preposition in Greek. It would basically be translated, I will make you fisher people. I will make you people fishermen. In that, I will make you fish for the sake of humanity, rather than making you fish for the sake of Rome. Rather than being Roman fishermen, one word being an adjective to describe the noun, what Jesus is saying is, I will save you from having to be Roman fishermen to being human fishermen. A people whose dignity had been stripped from them personally and professionally by imperial forces. Jesus is giving them dignity. And is saying, your work will bring dignity to others. I don't know, have you ever experienced been a part of, worked in, or seen others who've had careers that grate on the human soul? Work that serves only the economic interests of some corporate entity? For the life of me, I'm going to get on a little bit of a soapbox. I can't for the life of me understand why so many businesses keep such inhuman hours. I understand, but like hours that keep parents from time with their children, hours that prevent husbands and wives from being able to spend time together, hours that keep persons from any substantive rest for their weary souls, I cannot for the life of me understand why economic interests would take precedence over the well-being of humanity. You see, these businesses are serving corporate interests, not human interests. Just this morning, I read about someone who was laid off from Google after having worked at Google for 16 and a half years. He had given 16 of his years to Google. And do you want to know how he found out that he was being fired from Google? He didn't get a meeting with his manager. He didn't get 30 days notice that there was going to be a restructuring of the company. He didn't get a phone call. He didn't get an email. No, this guy found out that he was being let go from Google from an automated account deactivation at 3 in the morning. He woke up and his account had been deactivated without any prior knowledge, without any communication, no 30 days notice, no exit interview, no meeting or conversation with human resources. I wonder if Jesus is still saying to people today what he said back then, to a people who live in a land of darkness, to a people whose lives have not been given dignity. I wonder if he's still saying, follow me, and I will make you fish for the well-being of persons. Follow me, and I will make you fish for the sake of humanity. Not for the sake of Rome. I wonder if Jesus is still saying to people today, follow me, and I will make you an electrician that serves people. Follow me, and I will make you teach in a way that brings dignity to real human beings. Follow me, and I will make you build websites that lift people up. Follow me, and I will make you bank for people, not for corporate interests. Follow me, and I will make you heal people for the sake of people, and not heal people for the sake of the corporatization of hospitals. I wonder if we believe that following Jesus means that we can bring dignity to other people. That there would be a change in that. You see, I don't think Jesus actually changed their profession here. Let me be clear about that. He says, I will make you fishermen for people. He doesn't change their field, interestingly. Sure, they dropped their nets and followed him, and James and John, they left their father, but they're still fishermen. He's not saying you're not going to fish. And after the crucifixion, what do they do? Where does Jesus meet his disciples after the crucifixion? They're fishing again. Or maybe they're still fishing. Transformation, church, I don't think is always a change in circumstance. Maybe, yes, I don't want to be dogmatic about that, but transformation might not always be a change in circumstance or a change in career or a change in family. They are fishermen, after all. Transformation might be, church, a change in perspective. A change in purpose? A change in interests? A change in whose bidding you are doing? You see, instead of fishing for the bidding of Rome, Jesus is saying that they should fish for the interests of others. Fish for people. For the purposes of the kingdom. For doing the bidding of a king. Jesus uses the skills and the trades that these folk have and changes their purpose. Changes the purpose of their work for the sake of his kingdom, which is the restoration of all things. As Saint Irenaeus said, the glory of God is humanity fully alive. The glory of God is humanity fully alive. That is God's glory. When humans are not stripped of their dignity and divine purpose. And yet how much of our world is stripping real human beings of their dignity and of their divine purpose? What if to be a disciple of Jesus means that we will not live in such a way that others are stripped of their dignity? They're still fishermen, only they now fish for the kingdom of heaven, which has come near. And as I wrap up my message, I'm going to wrap it up here in just a minute. I want to reflect, if you will let me for a moment, on this metaphor, this image of fishing that Jesus employs here. Because these first disciples, we read in the text, they fish differently than we fish. How do you fish? If you fish, how do you fish? Rod and reel, of course. We almost always fish by casting a line. We first learn by pushing down the button, casting it out. Then you get the other kind where you pull the thing back and you hold the line and then you cast it and you don't let go and so it whips back. We catch one fish at a time by casting a line with some bait and a hook. And if you really know how to fish, you know what bait works with each species of fish, right? Different bait works with different fish. So you, if you want to catch the right fish, you know what you want to do. You want to know, if you're a good fisherman, you know that if you want to catch bluegill, use earthworms. That's why every kid catches bluegill. Because they're using earthworms. And you know that if you want to catch trout, use some crickets. Or some grasshoppers. And if you want to get some pike, we'll grab the spinnerbait, of course, naturally. I had to look all those up. But that's how we fish. That's how we understand fishing. It's the bait and switch. We lure them in. We get the bait they want. We lure them in, and then we hook them. That's not how the disciples would fish. I don't want to stretch the metaphor too far, but these fishermen were net fishermen. That is, they would make as big of a net as they could possibly hold and would cast it out over the open sea. And what they caught is what they caught. What landed in their net is what landed in their net. They weren't targeting a specific species. They were catching as many fish as they possibly could. And maybe that's the metaphor for what Jesus meant when he said he would turn these fishermen for Rome into fishermen for people. That is, what if the metaphor was not casting a line with bait and a hook? What if the metaphor is casting as big of a net as you possibly can? That is, what if our evangelistic method is more like the way we fish today than it was how the disciples fished? What if the evangelistic method of the 20th and 21st century is more like a rod and reel than it is a net. I mean, isn't that how we have ministered? I mean, this is how so many of our youth groups and children ministries and even adult ministries operate. I mean, a lot of the reason our churches are the way they are is because a lot of my generation and a lot of your generation were formed by an evangelistic strategy that said, we're going to party. Don't get me wrong, partying's great. Church should have fun together. But haven't we operated with an evangelism method that's more like a bait and switch? Oh, you got to come for the... We got the best music in town. We got the most exciting music in town. Man, our teen room is awesome. We got the most exciting teen group. And there's some really cute girls there. We come for the worshiptainment. You come for the exciting preaching. Oh, got to hear my preacher. And while we've got you at the bait, well, then we're going to hook you. We're going to try to keep you here. We got the specific bait for the specific demographic. We've got the specific marketing for the specific demographic so that we can get these niche communities to be a part of our church. That's not how the disciples fished. That was not the metaphor that Jesus had in mind. No, Jesus was saying you throw out as big of a net as you can possibly hold to catch as many fish as you can possibly bring in. And if you do that, guess what? You might just get more than you can handle. Remember the other story of the disciples fishing and Jesus said, cast your nets on the other side. We've been there before, Jesus. We'll do it again. Maybe that's what it means to become fishermen for people. Not bait and switch. Not lure and hook. But creating a space in which as many people know they belong as humanly possible. But cultivating a culture that tells people that you will be dignified. You know my biggest problems with evangelism over the last few decades is that I don't believe it dignifies people. It treats them as a product that we're trying to capture rather than as human beings who've been created in the image of God. Maybe that's what it means to fish for humanity. To create a space for as many people to belong as possible, even people from the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, even fishermen from Capernaum and Galilee who do the bidding of the empire, even those who we aren't expecting. He calls them not to leave their profession, but to utilize their profession for another purpose, for the purpose of the kingdom of heaven. For the sake of bringing as many people into the kingdom of God as possible. And that's what it means to come out of darkness. That's what it is to be a disciple. See, church, discipleship is not a place you go. Discipleship is not merely a thing you do. Discipleship is a culture. Follow me, and I will make you fish for people. Discipleship is a culture. It's a part of your identity. It is the culture of the kingdom of God. That whatever you do in your coming and your going, you do for the sake of the kingdom of God. And that means people aren't taken advantage of. It means that people aren't merely cogs in the corporate machine. It means that humans are granted the dignity that they deserve by being created in the image of God. It means that the purpose is for humanity fully alive, which is the glory of God. This is the good news of Jesus Christ for us today.